In the matter of Lopez versus Marmick and Ruane, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Andrew Weiss, Ciparelli and Associates, on behalf of plaintiff petitioner Sergio Lopez.
Good morning, Pete Weissman, on behalf of the New Jersey Department of Labor and Workforce Development, the NECAS.
Council, we're going to get about 20 minutes into the argument, break for a half hour at 12:30 for lunch. Mr. Weiss, if we get through your argument, terrific. If not, we'll come back. Let's try to get through.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I would reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you. I'd like to start by thanking the court for this opportunity today to address these important questions that this matter presents, not only for Mr. Lopez, but for New Jersey's workers, documented or undocumented, who depend on the equal enforcement of the state's wage and hour and wage payment laws. Petitioner, in this case, sets forth two primary contentions. First, that the appellate division erred in its determination that petitioner's immigration status in any context is relevant to his claims for work already performed under New Jersey's wage laws. And second, that the appellate division erred in affirming the existence of what has been called a barter arrangement as being anything other than employment under New Jersey's wage laws. The appellate division's reasoning through which it arrived at these errors is somewhat intertwined, and in examining these issues, I want to bring the court's attention to certain facts working from the ground up, so to speak. First, I think it's important to acknowledge that at the trial level in this case, in his claim for unpaid wages for work actually performed, Mr. Lopez testified to his job duties, his hours, and his compensation, and none of those three items were contested by defendants who failed to keep any records concerning the same. However, the trial court erred in its finding that plaintiff was not entitled to damages predicated on misapplication of the law concerning two issues raised here, petitioner's immigration status and the existence of a barter arrangement. In affirming the trial court's decision, the appellate division took the trial court's error a step further. Namely, the appellate division held that because of petitioner's immigration status, the Immigration Reform and Control Act, which I will refer to as the IRCA, and the Supreme Court's decision in Hoffman Plastic, therefore, there could not be any employer-employee relationship under New Jersey law. To the point that this precluded the applicability of the ABC test, and it precluded plaintiff from recovering any damages. Under this reasoning, the lower courts concluded that what was employment and employment relationship between plaintiff and defendants must have instead been a barter arrangement, which is an entirely novel concept based on no precedent under the law, and the invention of which has denied petitioner justice under New Jersey's wage laws in this case. This was error, legal error, because aside from U.S. law not preempting New Jersey's state laws, this holding flies in the face of the very purpose of the IRCA. It misapplies Hoffman Plastic, and it undermines the remedial purpose of New Jersey's wage laws. Indeed, the IRCA, Hoffman Plastic, and New Jersey's wage and hour laws contain no language to support the proposition that an individual's immigration status has any relevance to a claim for work already performed, much less to preclude such a claim. The statutory text of New Jersey's wage law extends its protections to all individuals who an employer suffers or permits to work without any regard to their immigration status. Precedent set by this court and the appellate division, much of which is cited in petitioner's briefs, as well as other courts in other districts and other states, all explicitly or implicitly stand for the principle that an individual's immigration status is not relevant in a claim for work already performed. The appellate division additionally erred in affirming the admission of evidence concerning plaintiff's immigration status vis-a-vis his testimony about his lack of a social security number on a W-4. The submission of this evidence as extrinsic evidence to attack petitioner's truthfulness means that the appellate division erred in that it should have precluded this evidence under rules 607 and 608C. As petitioner also focuses on in his brief, because an individual's immigration status makes no fact more or less likely in a claim for work already performed, this also should have been precluded entirely under Rule 401. Allowing the appellate division's decision here to go unchecked certainly risks opening the door to what would effectively be the weaponization of immigration status, in essence, to gut the remedial purposes of New Jersey's wage and hour statutes. Petitioner would also set forth that the appellate division erred in its affirmance of the trial court's misapplication of the Mount Clemens burden-shifting framework, which is codified in the NJSA under 34:11-58D, by improperly...
Can you say that one more time, that statute?
NJSA 34:11-58D. And the appellate division did so by improperly enhancing plaintiff's burden through stating that he is responsible for record keeping as opposed to the employer. Under New Jersey's wage laws, the burden of keeping records pertaining to an employee is a burden that is on the employer and that is part of the purpose of the burden shifting framework. And that the appellate division additionally erred in its affirmation of the existence of a barter arrangement being something other than employment and wholly disposing of the ABC test, which has been repeatedly affirmed by this court. In sum, because of the material facts of petitioner's work for approximately 3 years for respondents and respondents' failure to pay him in accordance with New Jersey's laws during that time, because those facts are undisputed, the only barrier to recovery in this case was the trial court's and the appellate division's legal error and misapplication of the law. And we therefore respectfully request that the court first unequivocally hold that an individual's immigration status is not relevant to whether an employer owes wages under the New Jersey wage and hour law and the New Jersey wage payment law, where the claim is for work that has actually been performed, and that this court reverse the appellate division's decision and remand this matter solely for the calculation and award of damages, as this approach would honor the record, avoid unnecessary litigation, and affirms the legal protections owed to all workers under New Jersey's law. I welcome the court's questions.
Would you be asking for a different judge to try the case on damages only?
Ideally, yes, Your Honor.
The credibility findings here weren't just based upon evidence that was questionably considered. It was also based upon statements from Mr. Marmick to the effect of, well, I may have worked 37 or I may have worked 60 hours, things that were quite indefinite in nature. Wouldn't you agree that that also would be relevant to a determination as to whether an accurate finding about the amount of hours worked would even be possible?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think that the matters concerning credibility are a bit of a red herring in this case. I don't think that determinations on credibility would have necessarily even been reached had there not been errors in the law, and that this case really rises and falls on the errors in the law. Much of the credibility determination is explicitly linked to petitioner's immigration status. To the extent of the specific part that I believe you're referring to, Mr. Lopez essentially testified to having worked long weeks and short weeks. And so there may have been some minor discrepancy between the amount of hours based upon his recitation of his schedule versus what he said the total hours are. But employees in these cases aren't expected to be statisticians or mathematicians. So for instance, if hypothetically somebody said in one of these cases that they worked 9 to 5, 5 days a week, and they believe that that total was about 42 hours. Under the Mount Clemens burden shifting framework, it's not proper here to say that because his schedule essentially testified to a 40 hour a week schedule, but he said that that is 42 hours, that you throw his claim out entirely. It would be that if there's not enough credible evidence to award him 42 hours of damages, absent any other evidence from the employer or any records of the employer, of course, that then he would be awarded the 40 hours. But to just throw the claim out wholesale because he didn't, a plaintiff hypothetically didn't add up his hours perfectly, doesn't really fit the remedial purposes of New Jersey's wage laws. It enhances, the burden on what are thought to be, or at least protections that are thought to extend to the most vulnerable populations of New Jersey's workforce. And, you know, these people shouldn't be expected to have records or to be able to multiply, figures to determine their overtime. They know what they went through. And here there was no question at the trial level that Mr. Lopez testified to the various duties he performed week in and week out. He was specific enough with his schedule that there may have been a minor discrepancy, but he didn't simply say, I worked 100 hours a week. He was explaining there was a long week and a short week because he had an alternating schedule. And there was no evidence from the defendants to contest any of those facts.
And you'd agree that value should be offset by the value of the lodging that he received?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that New Jersey's statutes provide for that.
Counsel, to what extent do the parties agree on how much time he did work?
I believe that the testimony elicited at trial that was, again, essentially uncontested, Mr. Lopez provided very good approximations of the amount of hours he performed each week, and defendants in response admitted that they did not track his time and they were not aware of how many hours he was working. Mr. Lopez also set forth the various duties and responsibilities that he was required to perform, whether that be sweeping, mopping, shoveling snow, taking out the trash. He listed, I believe, over 12 duties, that he regularly did throughout the course of his employment. And when asked about that on cross-examination, the defendant did not contest that he performed those duties for defendants throughout the time that he worked for them.
Counsel, you said this should be remanded, quote, if I heard you correctly, to affix the amount of wages that were due. Was that just a shorthand for saying the court at that point, the trial court, should conduct the analysis, the burden shifting analysis under Mount Clemens, and going through that process, assess what wages are owed?
Yes, if I understand Your Honor correctly, I'm asking that it be remanded essentially for a award of damages. I believe that the record is complete and that everything is there needed to assess plaintiff's damages in this case. I believe that he met his burden. It would have to possibly have a, accompanying instruction that plaintiff did meet his burden were Mount Clemens properly applied here. But this is a significant trial record in that there is no contest to much of these facts. And the only issues that arose in this case were the misapplication of law based on plaintiff's immigration status, which in effect gave rise to the existence of a barter agreement. But everything that is needed to determine damages in a New Jersey wage and hour case for work already performed exists in the record. It was put forth in petitioner's post-trial briefs after trial. And the only thing that essentially prevented this from getting there were these misapplications of Hoffman Plastics and the IRCA that somehow determined that there couldn't be an employer-employee relationship in this case, and that somehow plaintiff did not meet his burden potentially for not having employment records, which is certainly not plaintiff's burden to keep.
I take it that your client has put forth the evidence that he has and met his prima facie case, is what you're saying, his initial burden. Did the record cover the response that Mount Clemens would call for, with the employer then proffering evidence of the precise amount of work performed or negativing the reasonableness of the inference from the employee's evidence. Does the record cover that, or should that all be explored?
I believe the record's covered it.
The employer's component to this has been covered by the record?
Yes, the employer was specifically asked questions that cover that component on cross-examination. So I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That we didn't keep records, in essence.
That he didn't keep records, that while he certainly required plaintiff to perform his work and duties, he did not provide oversight and could therefore not contest that plaintiff was performing these duties for the hours described. There was certainly nothing on the level of providing with some level of exactness or documentation that plaintiff did not perform the work that he alleged. And so under the current record, there's absolutely no way for the employer to have met his burden once shifted under the Mount Clemens framework.
No additional evidence that your side or you anticipate the other side would need to introduce?
I can't speak for the other side, but there's no additional evidence that plaintiff would need to introduce. And I think that the issues were fully vetted during the initial trial. I think that the questioning occurred. I think that defendant's counsel had opportunity for questioning after the cross-examination of defendants, and that the record shows that there's nothing that would prevent plaintiff's recovery here were the law correctly applied under the Mount Clemens burden shifting framework.
Let me ask you a question about the use of the introduction of evidence about the false Social Security number. Are you saying that should have been kept out altogether?
Yes.
It lies at the heart of the factual narrative of what unfolded here. And in that respect, isn't it intrinsic evidence in this case?
I disagree. This is a claim for overtime and minimum wages for work already performed. What matters is when the plaintiff was working, how many hours, what his compensation was, maybe other issues on individual liability. But when it comes down to the narrative, defendants put forth this narrative primarily, right? That plaintiff was initially employed, that he was employed for some 2 to 4 week period. And at that point, the defendants, Mr. Ruane, the defendants, became aware that plaintiff did not have a valid Social Security number because he input what was his ITIN on a W-4 form. Now, their narrative in this case is that somehow at that point, despite plaintiff continuing to perform his work, continuing on his same schedule, only having increased duties over time, that something changed because of this false Social Security number. However, under the law and under New Jersey's wage and hour laws, nothing changed. The testimony was that he continued to perform the work. Nothing in his employment changed, so nothing about the no material fact to his wage and hour claims, the Social Security number is completely irrelevant. It doesn't change anything whatsoever. The only thing it could have possibly made a difference on is that at that point, if defendants did in fact find out that plaintiff had an invalid Social Security number, they could have terminated his employment. Defendants would have been entitled to do that. However, it's uncontested. Defendants did not terminate his employment. He continued receiving compensation in the form of an apartment and utilities. He continued performing the same duties that he was performing while he was actively employed or indisputably employed. And he continued having the same supervision of his work. Nothing else changed.
Are these who ultimately resolves these claims? If we grant relief and reverse,
in what sense?
Judge or jury? Who resolves these claims?
If we were to have
a court reverses this, the judgment of the appellate division, what happens next?
Our position is that the court should reverse it with a explicit instruction to remand only for the purpose of damages.
Right. There's no jury here, is my question. It's not a trick question. Is there a jury involved?
For the award of damages, no. The damages are statutory at this point, essentially.
The concern, as I gather, about the use of a Social Security number is that it not be a proxy, that it not be used as the sole basis to undermine credibility because of its nexus to the question of one's undocumented status. Isn't that what we should be telling judges not to do?
I do think that this court, that the lower courts need guidance
as opposed to stripping the evidence under some evidentiary theory altogether.
Sorry, what do you mean by that?
The fact that a false Social Security number would come in, but judges could not, or perhaps should not, rely on that as the sole basis to undermine credibility because of its intertwining with the ultimate question of one's immigration status.
Well, I would have to take the position that it shouldn't come in at all. I think this court should unequivocally hold that immigration status, and by immigration status, I mean any proxy for immigration status, is not relevant to claims for work already performed under the New Jersey wage and hour law and wage payment laws. It doesn't have any bearing.
You're saying that the defendant, in testifying as to what happened here, was precluded from saying that he paid Mr. Lopez for the first 2 weeks, or you suggested it was perhaps 4 weeks, and then when he found out that the Social Security number was invalid from his payroll operator, he told Mr. Lopez, I will not be able to pay you anymore because the payroll operator cannot process this payment because the Social Security number is incorrect. You're saying the defendant should be precluded from saying that, not only as the Chief Justice is asking that it should not be able to be used to determine Mr. Lopez's credibility, but you're saying the defendant should be precluded from saying at all that they learned that the Social Security number was incorrect and therefore told Mr. Lopez, our payroll officer, our payroll company can no longer pay you because there is no valid Social Security number.
That's correct in a sense. I believe that, you know, it certainly has no bearing on credibility. I think that could a defendant hypothetically in a situation like this say, my payroll company refused to pay? Maybe. I think that's even pushing the line, though. I don't think there's any reason why it's relevant. If we're looking at a wage and hour claim, we're looking at the work performed and the compensation. So really, the only relevant facts to whether or not this claim succeeds would be I paid him, you know, an extra amount of money for the first 2 weeks, and then after that, I only compensated him with the apartment and utilities. Whether or not the payroll can function, or whether or not that's even true, as I believe there was some testimony disputing whether or not the payroll could continue to pay, or whether he paid him in cash or by check, he continued to pay him for work, and he continued to have him perform work for him.
This is not a big point. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but imagine that there were an employment application that were submitted as part of this case, which did not have a Social Security number. Would that too be barred under the rules of evidence?
An employment application that did not have a Social Security number?
Yeah. Would you have an argument that that needs to be excluded under some evidence theory?
It's difficult to say because it's far afield from the situation that we're looking at right now. As far as this case is solely about work already performed. So if we're talking about a case where an employment application is denied, we're talking about prospective damages in a sense, or potential discrimination, which this court has ruled on in other contexts about immigration status being irrelevant for the chilling effect and being too unduly prejudicial. But then we're talking about emotional damages potentially. It's certainly different from the explicit claim of work already performed under New Jersey's wage statutes that are much more likened to the FLSA, which has there's a wealth of precedent holding this same standard that immigration status is irrelevant to those claims.
What rule of evidence bars the admission of this fact?
I would argue that 607 and 608, specifically 608C, does, because it's being used as extrinsic evidence to attack truthfulness.
What if there was an instruction that cannot be used for that? I thought the Chief Justice asked that, and you said that would not be sufficient, and it still couldn't come in even for the defendant to explain why they only paid for the first 2 weeks.
Well, I think that was what I was respectfully getting to that next, as far as I think there's a 401, 403 argument here, as far as I've stated, there's just absolutely no relevance. There's no material fact that is made more or less likely true by the admission of anything concerning an individual's immigration status. But the 403 argument as well, I think it's the last one, but this the appellate division has held in Serrano. This court has acknowledged in other cases, including Hargrove v. Sleepy's, the interorum effects and the undue prejudice that having immigration status come into these cases has on the undocumented population. And that chilling effect, once it gets out, in a sense, cannot be undone. It would dissuade undocumented workers from pursuing their claims. It would allow employers to potentially abuse undocumented workers by getting away with wage violations through employing them, therefore incentivizing the employment of undocumented workers, which is part of why the appellate division's decision undermines the purpose of the IRCA.
That's why I wanted to clarify. This is just information that a judge will hear. Is that fair? Does, at no point would this evidence be presented to a jury, correct?
I understand that, but I still think that there that the lower courts need guidance, that there needs to be more certainty, that there is precedence in this state for the idea that even at the discovery level, these facts should not come out. It's still just as it's being only heard by a judge and not a jury, hypothetically, it's still being made known to the plaintiff who might be terrified to be bringing a case in court due to their status. And so having this more clear guidance that maybe absent some sort of special showing, there needs to be that there just can't be any discovery into these issues, because in specifically claims for work already performed, they have no benefit whatsoever.
It's just in a matter of discovery. In this case, and you've laid out how it unfolded, and Justice Wynne-Raptor did in her question, the Social Security number was presented and led to a series of events. In that way, my question is it intrinsic to the narrative and thus admissible under 401?
I would still proffer that it's extrinsic evidence. It's not intrinsic to the narrative in that it's just because it happened during the events, it's really just a proxy for his immigration status overall.
Doesn't it explain what happened here? Can you really understand the sequence of events that led to the result that occurred here without knowing why there was a very abrupt change from a wage arrangement to a barter arrangement?
I understand the court's argument, so to speak, as far as passing the 401 analysis under that respect, but I think that it still doesn't hold up to the 403 analysis because it's too prejudicial. And you can understand everything that happened in this case that is relevant to these claims without those facts.
Counsel, I think I understood your argument to be that the trial court was bootstrapping the credibility argument in order to deny otherwise valid wage claims. And I think to the chief's point, isn't it possible to untangle this to allow for relevant evidence to come in that informs the situation and what occurred and perhaps advise or instruct and give guidance to trial courts to avoid the prejudice that might come when the Social Security number is being used as a proxy for immigration status?
I think the only appropriate guidance to give in that situation is that it should be held to be non-admissible. There's just absolutely no benefit. Benefit.
Let's say that the plaintiff's counsel is doing, as I'm sure you would, a very good cross-examination of the employer, and establishes that there's wage payments at this amount for 2 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever the date is, and then all of a sudden there's a barter arrangement involving housing and utilities. And if the employer then starts to explain what happens, would you then, should the court then say, no, don't explain it. You're not allowed to explain what happened. Is that really a the right way to develop the facts before a judge in a case like this?
I mean, I think in discussing any rules of evidence, there's always going to be the possibility of opening the door on cross-examination, so to speak. However, I would honestly liken this situation and the change in compensation, so to speak, to being a normal employee, hypothetically, whose pay went from $18 an hour to $16 an hour. Nothing changed with respect to their material obligations for their job. Nothing changed for their work. The only thing that changed is the compensation. And if the employer didn't terminate the employee on the basis of having found out that he was undocumented for the purpose of a wage and hour claim for work already performed, nothing else has changed.
Mr. Weiss, we've passed the magical time that we set out at the outset. Is there anything you want to add to your argument?
No, Chief Justice. Thank you. I've just reserved my time for
that. Of course. We're going to take a 30-minute recess and return.